Good evening. One of the ways that Dharma practice or Dharma study can be robbed of a lot of its power is if it turns into a kind of personal project, a self-improvement effort. Sometimes people turn up and announce that they want to learn how to meditate. And at least at our place, I know what they mean, obviously, but there's always a little bit of a funny feeling around it, like, oh, you want to learn how to meditate. Almost puts it in the same category of learning a new language or sport. And that actually keeps, even Dharma study can be kept in the realm of kind of ordinary karmic unfolding that way. So, one of the ways that we can avoid that trap is by practicing in a fashion that does not kind of even subtly feed into self-clinging. Buddhists, for the last 2.5 millennia, have confronted this issue. One way that some lineages have developed is by kind of invoking other powers. For instance, the Lama, or the so-called, in Tibetan Buddhism, the Yidam, the tutelary deities. And part of the function of that is, again, to remove Dharma study from any involvement with our trying to acquire something new and really great. And in our particular lineage, what we have been taught is, well, what if you were just to sit there? What if you were to suspend all agendas? Especially the agenda of, okay, now I'm going to learn how to meditate. Of course, there are lots of other things people could learn how to do that would be far less constructive than learning how to meditate. For instance, people could learn how to rob banks. And it's probably not as wholesome as learning how to meditate. But meditation, as we understand it, is something that comes quite naturally to human beings. And the more we are ready to, as Dogen puts it, cease all involvements, suspend all affairs. The more the natural quality of introspection, if you like, we use the word, the Japanese word, zazen, seated meditation, the more that natural quality can manifest in a way that we're not really, we can't really direct. So to facilitate that, we were offered a balanced posture. Where we should actually try to be, to some degree, comfortable, at ease. This is not meant to be a sort of strenuous undertaking, even though it has that, Zen in particular has that association sometimes. Sometimes that means that people going into a Zen retreat, they look very grim. If you've done a 7-day retreat, you probably know why. It can be a grim undertaking, particularly if we're not actually prepared to spend, you know, considerable chunks of time being at ease. And, you know, not really doing anything besides sitting there and being simply present for the phenomena of our life. Is something burning down? No? Oh, okay. All right. So the countervailing force, if you like, is what we call karma. And I know we've said many times, karma is the consequence of acting from wrong view. Wrong view is simply the deeply held literal belief in self and other as the basic underpinnings of our universe. Acting from that belief generates karma. So this practice quite deliberately flies in the face of that by suggesting that with as little self-involvement as possible, we take our seat and suspend all involvements. People have found it, to one degree or another, helpful over the centuries to formalize that a little bit so that it doesn't... If it's very, very sort of sloppy and kind of catch-as-catch-can and people do whatever they want, it will be difficult for other people to recognize that something maybe important is happening. It'll just look like a bunch of people flaking out. So in the Zen lineages, there's a kind of a formal arrangement of the practice space, and there are various things that you do that have that formal side, and the formality is a way to facilitate suspending all involvement. So someone just shows you, okay, this is how you do it, and then you just do it. And then you don't have to spend any time figuring out, well, what do I do next? How do I want to do this today? There's also, in some training environments, very uniform clothing. Pretty much everybody does the same thing, eat the same food, keep the same schedule. And again, all of this allows us to forget about planning and arranging. and to actually sit in peace, usually a while before we have any deep appreciation for what peace is. For most of us, if we, we're asked, okay, so what is peace anyway? Well, there's, world peace or political peace, which we don't have much at the moment. Personal peace usually means people, they're not particularly worried about anything, they're not agitated by anything, they're untroubled. And this again turns peace into kind of a subjective undertaking. How do I arrange my body mind so that I'm not concerned about anything and I don't, I'm not obsessing about stuff and so forth? How do I do that? So in that context, again, we remind people, well, it's not about you doing anything. And the challenge there often is that peace isn't something that we can grasp and establish. So it's not that one day we have figured out the peace formula, and then we can sit down and kind of make peace happen. That's just another pursuit. So when Dogen says suspend all involvements, that's what he means. And the karma of sentient beings is one of involvements and activities and affairs and so forth. So there's probably always going to be some pressure when we sit down to take up something, a favorite topic, a memory, a current obsession, whatever it is. There will be some karmic tendency to move into that space of activity. And then if we've heard the teaching that actually, why don't you just sit there and not do anything? Little by little, we come to recognize that that's a natural quality of our own body-mind, this not doing. It's not something we figure out or a knack we acquire. It's what's there already. And sometimes people will insist that if there are thoughts arising, then somehow they've missed the boat and they're not being peaceful. And then sitting practice becomes a sort of a whack-a-mole period where every time a thought comes up, you try to kill it, get rid of it. And this, of course, is simply agitating. It's just agitating to do that. So to find this, a place of balance where the natural calm can assert itself requires wholeheartedness, and at least initially you could call it a certain degree of faith, namely that somebody isn't just bullshitting you and making this stuff up so they can sneak away and laugh at you behind your back. So the instructions that we receive are pretty straightforward. Because sometimes people are so desperate, we tell them things like, well, you know, you can count your breathing if you want to do that. You can follow your breathing. There are, of course, many other styles of seated cultivation in Buddhism. You can, you know, label your thoughts, all kinds of stuff. You can take the germ or pivot from a Zen story and concentrate on that. These are all basically amusements, which eventually you will wear out. And if wholeheartedly we return to this natural place, which we actually never leave, at some point you will notice the inherent calm of the body-mind, which is not something that you have created or caused to be there. You have allowed it to arise. And you have allowed it to arise by generously permitting all of our usual preoccupations to fall away. Now, again, that sometimes conjures up the notion that, okay, I will now, in this moment, I will allow everything to fall away. And then in the next moment, something may arise, and you may be frustrated. It's like, wait a minute, I let you guys fall away. What are you doing back? Well, again, this is us trying to make the machinery operate in the way that we think it ought to. So instead of allowing falling away to go on happening, we again try to make it behave in the way that we think something called falling away behaves. So Dogen has this famous phrase, which maybe he heard from his Chinese Chan teacher, Tiantong Rujing, about body and mind dropping off, or body and mind falling away. And again, people sometimes hear that and think that that's something that they have to figure out how to trigger or make happen. And that's not what that means at all. The nature of the body-mind is such that it is constantly falling away. Constantly. There's nothing there to grasp. And to sit in the wholehearted, I don't know what to call it, commitment or something to that truth is the wholeness of practice right there. We're such creatures of language, of course, so embedded in language, that we tend to associate meditative practice with no language manifestations in the mind. So generally, during retreats, for instance, most of us, myself included, sometimes give in to the temptation to do something interesting with the mind. And after a certain amount of time has passed in a balanced and relaxed posture, features of consciousness may manifest that are kind of irresistibly attractive and look like they would be fun to play with. So sometimes people will figure out how to get themselves in a place where there is little or no linguistic activity in the mind. And some people think that's very interesting, and some people find that scary. So when I was helping lead retreats, it wasn't unusual for someone to come up and say, "I have to talk to you. My thoughts have gone away." And they're like upset. And I'm like, "Congratulations. What do you mean you're upset? That's really great." And I usually have to remind them, "Did you notice that we're talking? So actually, language is working just fine. You're unaccustomed to the fact that the mind can be this quiet. And it makes you uneasy, but actually, you're doing great. So, you know, get on back to the Zendo and relax some more." Usually that's enough. And people say, "Oh, cool. I thought I was like nuts." It's like, no. Congratulations on seeing this aspect of consciousness. And now you can let that go. "Oh, you mean I shouldn't go back and make that happen again?" It's like, no, I wouldn't do that. You know, it happened. This is a manifestation of ancient roots of practice from many lifetimes. So that's great. You can appreciate that. But don't get hung up on it. Otherwise, your practice will become this tight, self-involved little affair. And you don't want that. Sometimes during a Dharma talk, I have to wait a while before anything emerges in my mind to say. And if it goes on long enough, I get a little nervous because I feel like, oh, people are going to like, "Come on, come up with something. It's supposed to be a Dharma talk and you're just sitting there." So it was a while before I could actually trust that process. And if it meant a Dharma talk where I said like half a dozen words and nothing else, it's like I decided I would trust that. And if the audience, you know, responded with pitchforks and torches, then I would just have to find some way to deal with that. At the moment, the most compelling manifestation in this body mind is the aroma of lavender, which keeps wafting over here. And it makes me very inclined just to sit here and smell lavender. And one, I guess, reason where that feels so complete is that I actually trust that our body minds are at base still. They are still. And there is room for any phenomenon to arise or not arise. So the scent of lavender fills the body mind. And is indistinguishable from peace, quiet, stillness. This sort of this way of cultivation is extremely important for our world, for obvious reasons. It doesn't seem very likely that humankind is just going to wake up tomorrow and everybody's going to want to sit in stillness. I don't think that's going to happen. And in the meantime, people have complicated lives. Difficult situations, difficult feelings, difficult relationships. And if we don't have this sense that there is something profound yet ungraspable that is completely trustworthy, it's very easy to get tossed around in the midst of the phenomena of our life. I recently heard that someone I hadn't seen in a long time, but I practiced with, was assaulted and severely beaten for no reason. And when I learned that, I had to admit I had a murderous response, and thought, I'd like to find out who did that. And make them pay. So, in our human world, this sort of stuff comes up. And without this sense of something profound and deep about us that isn't moved, then it's very easy to get drawn into paths of action that are destructive, harmful for ourselves and others. And I presume that's obvious to everyone. So to trust ourselves to this profound and still quality of the body-mind is what Dogen, the Japanese founder of this style, called the backward step. He says quite simply, take a step back from the frantic, constantly buzzing activity that is like the surface of our life. Take a backward step. And in so doing, he says, what he calls the light turns and illuminates what's here, rather than the habitual orientation, which was to use the light, which you might say the light of, I don't know, life or consciousness or something, to illuminate what's out there. It says, step back from all of that busy activity, let the light revolve and shine on what's here. And in so doing, suspend all your involvements. Find a way to be comfortable. And if you do, if you're looking for a way to be comfortable, you may notice our restless tendency to move quickly away from any discomfort. That's, again, part of our the karma of body, speech, and mind is to avoid any discomfort and move towards the pleasant. So eventually the kind of agitating quality of that ceaseless pursuit becomes obvious to us. And then it's possible to be very composed and very settled in bodily and mental circumstances that at one time we might have decided were really uncomfortable and really needed to be gotten rid of. So it's very common for people who cultivate a sitting practice to have a certain amount of discomfort in the joints or muscles or what have you, and then there's all naturally a kind of mental emotional reflex of that. But it's possible we find that because of this deeply rooted quality of stillness, that there is much about what we would call discomfort that is trivial. We don't actually have to respond to. We just recently finished our once a year retreat, and I try to make a point of reminding people that being in retreat is not about enduring misery, and that if the voice of the body is loudly requesting attention that we're not giving it, we should give it some. Okay, maybe try a different posture. You know, back is really hurting. I don't think this is very good. My knees are killing me. Maybe I'll sit in a chair and do nothing instead of sitting cross-legged. So I'm talking about stuff that is common to all of us. I don't have any special accomplishments. If you continue Dharma study long enough, often someone will ask you, start asking you stuff about Dharma study. It's like, oh, well, right. But it's not based on any special accomplishment. And the, I don't know what, the, I guess, I could, with some misgivings, use the word realization of that, is the basis for, in our lineage, for one's teacher saying, okay, now you have responsibility for the lineage. It's what we call Dharma transmission. It has nothing to do about some special accomplishment. So I'm speaking of what Brother David Steindl-Rast calls the ground we share. And he was, it's the title of one of his books, he was talking about where Christian and Buddhist understandings meet. But it can also refer to the ground we share as humans, as sentient beings, which is the basis for our being established in practice in Dharma. It's possible to dress all this up in elaborate and exciting costumes. But it's not necessary. The Zen Chan tradition, as you know, is has collections of hundreds of stories. Which showcase or express more fully the human potential. The human potential is not so constrained by culture and habit. And therefore opens many more possibilities to us for acting and being in the world in a way that is beneficial, or at the very least, not harmful. And it's something I work with a lot. Because as I have confessed many times, I'm what Buddhism calls a hate type. And so there I was this morning on my way to Sacramento. Crammed with my luggage onto a Muni metro car. It was very crowded, people standing. There was a seat next to me, and a gentleman got on and was interested in the seat, but seemed to feel that it was not wide enough. So, and I was the guy with the luggage, so he seemed to think that I was, you know, causing problems in his life, because there I was with my luggage, trying to be as small as possible. It wasn't working, at least not to his satisfaction. So a couple of times he says, "Can I sit down?" I'm like, yeah, sit down. And he seemed to want to convey that I should be even smaller. So I confess, I was rather irritated at this point. It's like I wasn't anywhere to go. And so, for some reason, without thinking, I spoke to him in French. I don't know why I did that. It just happened. And that seemed to puzzle him, which I thought was, okay, that's fine. It's fine if he's puzzled. So he finally sat down and was muttering various imprecations. And I was sitting there still trying to shrink. And I realized, you know, I probably didn't make his day any better. And I was sorry about that. And I realized maybe, you know, someone who's not a hate type could have come up with something different. And in fact, a gent who was sitting like right there, so I don't know if you know how these metro cars are set up, but anyway, everything's very squeezed together, and there was a gent sitting right there, and he said to me, maybe if you turned your suitcase the other way. I thought, yeah, okay. So I turned it the other way. And I thought, that I like that better. You know, it didn't even occur to me to try to turn the suitcase the other way. Frankly, it didn't seem to make that much difference, but it was a gesture, and it might have eased the passage of this gentleman who seemed to be even in a worse mood than I. And I was sorry that my habit mind didn't immediately make that available. So maybe answering him in French was better than saying something nasty in English. And I didn't say anything nasty in French. I just said, it's not possible. Everyone's squeezed in here. And he evidently didn't speak French, so disinvited him to sit down and mutter nasty things in English, thinking this guy doesn't speak English anyway. So, but these are the this is the experience of a hate type, who's kind of bad tempered, and has that karmic tendency to engage angrily with the world. And it seems that there are quite a few hate types out there. So for me, cultivating what's the expression? Not a deep peace works, but great peace, sometimes we say in Zen. Great peace. Cultivating great peace is the peace that you can't manipulate. The peace that's already there. This is very helpful for maybe all types, but definitely for hate types. So if any of you out there are hate types, I suggest this practice. But it also works well for greed types and confusion types. And you know who you are, so... But as the old story in the Book of Serenity says, the problem, it doesn't say this, but you come to realize that the problem with what that particular text calls the work of great peace is that it has no sign. So you can't really say, oh, there it is. Like, that looks like it. It's like, it doesn't look like anything. Sometimes it's called the accomplishing work of great peace. And it has no sign. It just looks like life. So to be willing to sit as the accomplishing work of great peace, with its complete absence of signs, is a very powerful and very transformative practice. And that's what we call Zazen. It has other names, but that's what we do. Lavender is a rather soothing aroma. Maybe I should carry a little lavender thing when I'm on the Muni Metro. Sniff it. It could be the gentleman for whom the seat was too narrow. Even though he was a skinny guy, I didn't see the problem anyway. you know, the metro car, there were a lot of people who were, there was one lady wearing, you know, reindeer antlers and kind of Santa socks, and there were people with packages who'd been shopping. This gentleman didn't look like he was enjoying the holidays. And I wasn't either, so I could sympathize. But that probably made everything worse, that there's all this, you know, jingle bells, ha-ha, everybody's having fun. It's like, no, everybody isn't having fun. Some of us are definitely not having fun. And the pressure to have fun is just makes it all worse. If you already have some tendency to be irritated, like me, having people running around kind of urging you to be, you know, cheerful makes it all worse. So this is all in retrospect, right? The moment, in that moment, all I could do was speak in French. So, okay. No harm was done, I don't think. He didn't hit anybody, or me. And finally he ceased his muttering. And so we all settled into an easy truce. I thought, okay, maybe that's the best we can do right now. And I think it was probably obvious that I was somewhat irritated. And when I realized that that was the case, I had my mala. So I kind of... No, I'm not a Buddhist. I'm just, you know... Because the hairstyle kind of gave me away. And it's very embarrassing. I was like, you're supposed to be a Buddhist. Okay, so like, chill out. Be peaceful. Beneficent. It's like, okay, I'm trying. Anyway, that's our life. And Mrs. Akira, she said, you know, the more you practice, the more you have this wonderful power. And in true and marvelous Zen fashion, he doesn't say what it is. But he's right. And when he was giving that talk, he tells this peculiar story about one of the famous teachers and his students. But the story doesn't seem to have anything to do with some wonderful power, which makes it perfect. And it's the story where, I can't remember exactly who it was. It was Guishan and some other folks. They were the students. And one of them, Guishan, came to his teacher's, I think this is where she says cabin, which of course this was happening at Tassahara, so cabin was the word. But, and his teacher was lying down. And at some point in their exchange, the teacher says, I had a very interesting dream while I was napping. And then Guishan says, oh, what was your dream? And the teacher says, what do you think it was? Thus, the wonderful power. I have a little timer here. Telling me I've been blathering for 50 minutes, so maybe that's enough. But I wonder if you have some questions or comments. How's your Christmas shopping? Oh, yes.
I'm curious about where those tight things come from, really. And then also I'm wondering, you know, is that really useful to... Mm-hmm. because maybe that just kind of reinforces some story you have about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not what it's supposed to do. I don't know how old that is. I suspect it goes pretty far back. The context in which that arose was, if one is a such and such, like a hate type, there were particular practices which were thought to be most effective. So, for hate types, one of the prescriptions was to study the perfection of wisdom, which, as Edward Kanza liked to put it, gives you the whole universe to smash. Everything empty, gotten rid of. Right? So that's very good for hate types because they can smash the whole universe. And then there are similar practices. For instance, if you're a confusion type, it's good if you're an accountant. And you hi there. And you spend a lot of time doing punctilious attention to lots of detail. This is very good for confusion types. Greed types, there are a number of practices that are good for greed types. One of them is corpse contemplation. So if you're a greed type, it's very helpful to contemplate the stages of decomposition of a corpse. I don't know who figured that out, maybe Buddha, but anyway, that's where this type thing comes from. But you're right, if it becomes an imprisoning story, that's not that helpful. So I try to avoid that. And I try to avoid taking secret delight in being a hate type. But that's kind of where it comes from. But you're right, if any of these teachings become a burden, then we're doing something wrong. So thanks for pointing that out. Yes.
Could you say something about the apparent contradiction between Dogen's advice to turn the light within and illuminate the self,
mm-hmm.
and the teaching of no self?
Well, the self properly illuminated is revealed not to be there. So it's not really a contradiction. If the self is illuminated, one can see, oh my God, that's actually... it's nothing but a process. There's no person there. There's just stuff happening. That's all. So that's where that comes from. So it's not actually a contradiction, although it might seem like it.
Yeah. Is that process? Is that what Dogen meant by the self?
Yeah.
So in that sense.
There is a conventional self, yes, there is. And the mistake is to give that ontological or existential primacy on this side, and everything else is out there.
You said conventional self. Mm-hmm. Are you referring to the process?
Yes.
The experience of the process?
Yes.
The observation of the process?
Mm-hmm.
Because
it's a convention that's who we are. That's the conventional understanding is, oh, that's me. Me. Me, 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 me. And Dogen says, well, actually, if you let the light turn and look at carefully at what is emerging as this conventional self, you'll see that there's nothing but process.
That's not conventional. That's the observation that there's nothing but process.
That's not so conventional, no. It'd be nice if it were, but no.
The convention is the ideas that accrued around that.
Yeah.
About social security cards.
Well, there's an unchanging, supremely sovereign person here. That's the convention. Yeah. That's the convention. And Dogen says, if you look, you'll see that that's not so. You'll see that that conventional thing is constantly falling away, falling away. Does that help at all? Yeah. Senor Accountant. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the wonderful power. Yeah, well, it could have been worse. I could, a number of things occurred to me that would not have been helpful to say, which would sort of match the gentleman's irritated frame of mind. And fortunately, what came out was in French. Well, I don't know how sophisticated it sounded. It sounded definitely foreign. Oh, this guy's a foreigner. Well, no wonder he's taking up too much room. It's like, okay. All right. But then, as I said, this other guy said, why don't you turn your seat? Oh, okay, cool. Thank you. So I thought, oh, maybe next time I'll be the one to think, oh, I could just turn my suitcase. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Dharma study definitely can include sutras and such, but at the heart, it's about turning the light. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to trust that process is an act of great generosity, among other things. It's one of the perfections, dana paramita, just whole body, mind, trusting that is a great, generous gesture. Thank you all for coming out on this cold evening. And thank you, Ino-san, for getting the heat working. Oh, did it quit? Well, I guess we're warm enough anyway. Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of Tassajara. Zendo, before they put any heat in, they would try all these ridiculous, approaches to deal with the fact that it was like 18 degrees outside and about, 35 degrees inside. So one of the things they used to do was they'd drag in this enormous piece of equipment that seemed to be some kind of a propane heater, which made this horrible roaring sound. You remember that? The, quote, the dragon.
No, I couldn't remember
the asphyxiation
approach.
Oh, the asphyxiation approach. Light all the lamps. Well, this kind of added to that. So somebody would start that thing at 20 minutes before Zazen or something, and it would warm the place up a little bit, and then they'd turn it off and drag it out of the zendo, and then open both of the doors so that the abbot could walk in with this blast of cold air. So why even bother? Why even bother with that? Anyway, now they have some heat in there from the hot springs water. Why didn't they think of that back then? Well, because there were people around who thought that Zen students should be cold and pinched and miserable all the time. And I hope we've gotten away from that now. Mm-hmm. Well, now that I am older, I'm not so interested in that kind of ascetic practice anymore. It can be very helpful at times, but a little bit goes a long way. Anyway, it was lovely to see you all again. Enjoy the holidays, if possible. And if someone irritates you, speak French. Thank you very much.